Hi there. Thanks for listening to Alt Latino. NPR's brand new politics podcast is where NPR's political reporters talk to you like they talk to each other. With weekly roundups, short takes on news, and reporting from every stop on the campaign trail, you don't have to keep up with politics to know what's happening this election year. You just have to keep up with them. Listen and subscribe to NPR's politics podcast at npr.org/podcast and on the NPR One app.
Esa negrita que va caminando, esa negrita tiene su tumbao. Y cuando la gente la va mirando, ella baila de lado, también apretado, apretado, apretado.
From NPR Music, this is All Latino. I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Jasmine Garst, and today we get to interview the interviewer. Joining us here in our New York bureau is renowned journalist Soledad O'Brien.
Soledad.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
It's my pleasure.
Oh my gosh.
So I just want to get up and dance.
Yeah, right? Okay, so you...
Forget the interview. Let's just dance through the segment.
As our guest DJ today, Soledad, you brought in a ton of great music, but we want to know, first off, why Celia Cruz singing this song?
First of all, you know, I'm Cuban-American. My mother was born in Havana, so I think that every Cuban looks to Celia Cruz like a goddess. And of course, my experience was that every Cuban, especially little old Afro-Cuban you know, would tell you how she knew Celia Cruz, right? So my grandmother had a story, and if you believed her story, which, by the way, I'm only... 22% sure it's true.
like all grandma stories.
It could be a complete fabrication. But she would talk about how, oh, you know, I grew up with Celia Cruz. I knew Celia Cruz. And so I always held this idea, and I would get to interview Celia Cruz occasionally, a couple of times. And I would tell her, you know, my grandmother says she grew up, which of course elicited a completely blank stare, like, uh-huh.
Everyone else.
But, you know, I don't know. It always reminds me of my grandmother, actually, who left Cuba in the 1980s and was able to come to the United States and then died not long after she came.
When you were growing up, did people around you know who Celia Cruz was?
Not a soul. Oh, my goodness, no. The town I grew up in was, clear 99%, I'd say, percent white, mostly Italian, Jewish, some Irish, a very typical northern Long Island, North Shore of Long Island town. No diversity. I think there was one Japanese girl in my class, one Korean girl in my class, maybe one other black girl in my class. My family, I'm one of six kids, so we probably made up, you know, more just that. We tipped the scales and the Afro-Latinos because there were just so many of us. But really, that was it for diversity-wise. And so when people would ask me about my childhood and about, you know, kind of race conversations, there was just no critical mass even to discuss diversity because literally there were probably five people of color in, you know, my class in some capacity. So we never really had any of those conversations where you discussed any issues about being the lone people of color in a bigger context that was, you know, mostly white.
You talk about that in your book, and you've talked about that in interviews as well. Tell us a little bit about your family background.
My mom is Cuban. She was born in Havana in 1930. And my dad is Australian, and he was born in Toowoomba, Australia, in Queensland, a couple of years after my mom. So they met in the United States in the late 1950s when they both, my mom was at a convent school in Havana and was able to get to the Baltimore version of that convent school. And so that's where she ended up doing her studies in Baltimore. And then my dad came to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And they met because they both went to daily mass. And my dad used to, you know, basically hit on my mom and ask her if she wanted a ride to church.
At the church.
So romantic, I guess. And she used to turn him down, of course, because you don't take a ride from someone you don't know well, even if you're going to sit next to them every day in church. So one day my mom said yes, that she would in fact take a ride. She accepted his offer of a ride, and they made a date to go on a date. And every place in Baltimore, Maryland in 1958 wouldn't serve them, of course, because my mom's black and my dad's white. My mom's Afro-Cuban, my dad's white Australian. And so my mom eventually took my dad back to her apartment and made him an amazing meal of Cuban food, like all Cubans. She cooks, you know, phenomenally. And so that was, you know, her whole entire story that she used to tell me and my three sisters and sometimes even my two brothers was this whole idea of if you could cook, you know, right. You could get a life partner because the important thing was cooking. Nothing about discrimination. Let's not talk about segregation.
You know, a lot of times on this show when we talk to people and including, you know, me and Felix's story, a lot of parents want to protect their children from being a Latino or a black kid in America as much as possible. And a lot of times that means not teaching your kids Spanish.
Oh, yeah, my mom did that.
Or telling, you know, when I decided to do this show, my mom, she was like, well, you could pass as non-Hispanic. Why are you doing that? Did your mom talk to you in Spanish? Did she try to kind of shelter you from that?
Yeah, I think she did. She didn't. She intentionally didn't have us speak in Spanish at home because the community that we were in, there was no critical mass. Like it wouldn't even, no one would make fun of you because you spoke Spanish at home. You would just be like a unicorn with two heads. It would be that weird. I mean, it would be bizarre. It just didn't happen. And so my mom very intentionally did not have us speak Spanish at home. And very intentionally, you know, I didn't learn Spanish until I was a 10th grader in high school. And, you know, and so I think that her part of, as you describe it, right, part of it is to help. Like, let's just ease the path for you to fit in with everybody here. Let's not make you stick out. Come on, let's just get along. And I think they did do that. I think they did have a sense of, we don't need to fight every battle. You know, let's just ease some of these paths down the way. Although I often tell the joke that I saw a picture of our family from the 1970s, probably 1976. I was probably about 10 years old. And my dad's white and bald. My mom's black and has a giant Angela Davis afro, massive. And then six brown kids, all with afros. It's 1976. Head to toe polyester and that thick kind of polyester that existed back then. And then, you know,
I wouldn't know about that.
Stripes for the top, you know, the horizontal, vertical stripes on our pants, you know, because that's how you used to dress. And we're leaned jauntily against our white VW bus. And I remember looking at this picture thinking, we probably could have gone with the Spanish because this is not a picture of blending into white, Italian, Jewish Long Island at all. I mean, it was so ridiculous. Like, just the idea of like trying, you know.
Okay, let's take a music break. The next band you brought in is by the influential Cuban band Los Vanva. Now, why did you choose this band?
You know, I remember when I went to Cuba to visit my cousin, and she just loved Los Vanva. But she had no access to Los Vanvan, of course, you know. And so I eventually snuck her in a CD and batteries so she could play it on her, you know, her Walkman. I just loved it. I mean, it was such a crazy thing to think, here's a group that's so popular in this country, and yet this woman who's in this country has absolutely no access to them. No money to go to a concert, no ability to listen to them on a radio that she can't afford batteries for. You know, so it was just really heartbreaking. And so to me, they're symbol of just this wildly popular and fabulous group that even many of the people can't appreciate because they don't have access.
Okay, this is Temba Tumba Timba from Los Vanvan.
hacerte una versión de las tantas que han habido. Dos mujeres y tres maridos buscaban su ubicación. Dos mujeres y tres maridos buscaban su ubicación. Hacer cambio de vida y no hay nadie que la entienda. No quiso bailar más rumba y quiso cambiar de estilo, cambiando al temba por tumba. Así cambia de marido, cambiando al temba por tumba. Así cambia de marido.
Okay, Soledad, that's some of the music that you listen to now, Los Van Van from Cuba. But what were you listening to when you were growing up? I mean, did you have any music at all that reflected your Afro-Latino heritage?
No, you know, not very much. My parents, my dad loved Dionne Warwick, so we listened to Dionne Warwick.
So
I remember we had, obviously, turntables. And my mom never listened to music from her homeland. I think she was very, she'd left her whole family behind. I remember one day she came into the bathroom. I probably was in high school. And she looked at me and she just said, you know, today I spent more time in this country than I have in my own country. And it was just very depressing for her. So she never listened to old music from, you know, from Cuba at all. Never. Never, never, never. She was not a, you know, I know so many people whose parents sort of brought the music from their old country. I think it was too painful for my mom to do that.
It's really interesting that you said that. That's like a milestone that I know a lot of immigrant people and I'm actually thinking, you know, I have a long way to go, but that's this milestone when you've spent more time in this country than in your own country.
It was
and
such,
it's something intense.
It was such a depressing thing for her. It was not said with any joy. It
right.
was just sort of said like, I guess that, you know, I guess I'm not going back.
Right. It's a milestone. When did you start getting your appreciation for the music then? When did you dip your toe into all that?
You know, I think it really wasn't until probably I got out of college and I started traveling. When I started working and doing trips to Cuba for work,
sure.
I really, you know, I just loved the music. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not hard to love. And I think it was just also a matter of just growing up. And, you know, it's funny, I'm back to top 40 music because I have four kids. The oldest is 15 and my next daughter's 13 and my twin boys are 11, right? So I can now sing along with the radio because we put hits one or whatever it's called.
Right,
you know,
right.
I've lost all ability. I have all control of the radio in the car, and we just listen to, you know, Justin Bieber all the time.
You got a witness right
so
here.
So I feel like I've circled back around to top 40 from my childhood. But when I'm alone on my own, you know, when I'm listening to my own music, yeah, I love it. I love it, and I loved it when I was in Cuba. And I liked it as I grew up, and my interests were sort of piqued about my own background and the things that I was interested in.
Okay, now let's hear a song that ties together your interest in Cuban music and your connection to a city you discovered as a result of your journalism. We're going to play a track called Mardi Gras Mambo, and it's by the Cuban band Cubanismo, and it features New Orleans vocalist John Boutte. And then we're going to hear an earlier version of this popular song.
Down in New Orleans, where the blues are born, take a look out.
Okay, now the New Orleans band The Meters with their classic version of the song.
Mardi Gras, mambo, 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 mambo.
So that did New Orleans become a big part of your life after you worked on post-Katrina coverage?
Yeah, weirdly, because I'd never really been to New Orleans. My best friend and my producer, Kim Bondi, is from New Orleans, but I'd never visited her hometown, and I didn't really think anything of it until after Katrina, when I started spending a lot of time in New Orleans. And Katrina ended up being a really important story for me, and I felt very, I made a lot of friends in that city, and I ended up really starting a foundation that would start with girls in New Orleans. We ended up expanding, so we have scholars around the country. We send girls to and through college. I joined the board of the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra because I love jazz, and I was really interested in helping them keep jazz alive in a city that sometimes doesn't appreciate jazz all that much, even though it's the birthplace of jazz. So I really started being very connected to that city.
In the book, you don't skirt around the topic of being a woman on television and looks. I was relieved. I was almost like, oh, is she going to talk about this? I know a lot of young women are so hypnotized by television as a format. And a lot of people, you know, feel like television is a place that is very cruel to women. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that segment in which you talk about beauty and being a reporter on television?
Yeah, you know, it's so disappointing because the actual work itself, like the art of being a reporter, is so not connected to looks at all. But to get a job, certainly on TV, you have to have this sort of, at least a certain kind of look. Otherwise, you'll just find yourself drummed out eventually. And really, I mean, I had bosses early on who, you know, made it very clear, like, if they found you attractive, that was going to be good for your career. You know, those completely, you know, they're very open about it. But yeah, you know, I guess I never really thought about the looks part of it until I started being on camera. I'd been a producer first, you know, and then you were like, okay, I guess I'm attractive enough. You know, if I put some makeup on and try, I can be a little more attractive. You know, if I remember eyeliner, I'm really attractive. But I don't know. It just, you know, it became, it's a depressing thing because I do think women in media have a bit of an expiration date. And I do think it's based around, do other people find you attractive? Which is so stupid because the act, again, of journalism is about writing and storytelling and delivery and, you know, and understanding stories and being a good interviewer, all things that really, you know, it doesn't really matter what you look like. But unfortunately, it's TV.
So what would you recommend to a woman who is entering the world? Like, how do you brace yourself for that? How do you prepare or how do you fight back?
You really can't fight back. That's just, I mean, I think that's the way it is. And I think if you really want a career and you're a young woman, if you spend your time fighting back, you probably won't get to the goals that you have in your career. You just won't get done the stuff that you need to get done. And if you're new and you're young and you have to learn to write and you have to learn to interview and you have to learn to edit yourself and you have to learn to get better and you have to learn to do a rundown. I mean, like, there's stuff to spend time on.
Sure.
And it can't just be second guessing how you look. So to me, I mean, the advice that I give the young women that I've worked with is always, you know, figure out the uniform. You know, I always wore black, and a colored jacket. So my entire wardrobe in when I was a new reporter was all black with a yellow jacket or a red jacket or a blue jacket. You know, just a real uniform of, you know, hair good enough, makeup good enough, and clothes just fine. Because I think you have to kind of make it a non-issue and focus on the work. You know, the work is, you know, and I don't know that, you know, that's, I would advise someone to, yeah, fight back against this. Don't spend so much time learning how to write when really what's going to help them is learning how to write. But it's a very frustrating thing, you know, because you don't want to lie to people. It's definitely part of the game, and it's frustrating.
Part of your work now includes a series of town hall-styled meetings in Latino communities across the United States called I Am Latino in America. And you recently had the vocalist Gaby Moreno at one of your events in Texas.
Un, dos, tres, cuatro.
So I met Gabby Moreno at the Hispanic Heritage Awards. And then we asked her if she would be part of our Latino in America tour that we're in the middle of right now. And she came and performed the other day when we were in Texas and sang for the audience. And it was amazing.
Vengo desde muy lejos, buscando el azul del cielo, siguiendo predicamentos. Vengo desde muy lejos.
And she's just a very beautiful soul. You know, she's just a really thoughtful young woman who has, like, gravity beyond her years. She's just someone you like to be around. So we were so grateful when she said yes, she would join our tour, which was amazing. And I love her music.
Okay, Soledad, you've worked at local TV stations. You were a respected field producer for NBC News. Then you were a celebrated morning anchor on CNN. You did documentaries for them. Now you have your own production company, Starfish Media Group. Tell us about what you hope to do with Starfish.
When I left CNN, I took with me most of the content that I had created over the years at CNN, which was a tremendous luxury. It's huge. And which means we have a library. And so we really build on those stories. And I think what we did well and started at CNN, now at Starfish Media Group, we continue to tell stories of people's voices that really often don't kind of get the mic. I think we started something at CNN in saying, you know, there is a story about gay people in America. You know, that hasn't really been told. And it's not the, it's their story, not my story of them, but it's their story of what's important to them. And it doesn't fit the traditional, stereotypical stories that we all do. So if we're going to do a story on Latinos in America, maybe we'll tell the story of a Latina boxer who's going to the Olympics. You know, maybe we'll tell the story of the Garcia family, because the name Garcia is the eighth most popular name in America right now. And what does that mean for America if it's the eighth most popular name? It's broken the top 10. You know, so there are other stories to tell that don't have to be the same old, same old, same old. And I think that's what we were trying to do in Black in America, too. You know, what were the stories that you could tell about people that were just different, and giving a mic to a different group of people who had something to say? So, you know, that's really what our focus is at Starfish Media Group. We've had some really great opportunities. We've done some projects in, you know, in a children's prison, taking a look at some of those, you know, kids who've been in solitary confinement. We did a great doc the other day about heroin in the suburbs. We've did another Black in America that just looked at policing in New York City around Stop and Frisk, all with, you know, CNN and other partners. So we just actually came back from shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, looking, we did a town hall with Pharrell Williams on race and reconciliation. You know, so I think anytime you get to bring in voices and have people's, you know, have their side heard, it's a very powerful thing. I feel very grateful to be able to do that kind of work and enjoy it, and it does well, and it's fun, and, you know, it just feels really rewarding.
When was the last time a story or a documentary you reported made you cry?
Oh, gosh. I cry all the time. I'm such a crier. I cry constantly. I cry at, like, a really good Hallmark commercial. I cry. I mean, I you know, if I'm feeling sorry for myself, I cry. If I can't do the move in Bikram yoga, I cry. I can't do standing bow. I just can't get my leg up there.
Soledad O'Brien, thank you so much for coming in.
It was my pleasure.
This has been
thank
you so much. We've been looking forward to this for a long time. And you brought in a band that has the touch of a connoisseur in terms of Latin music.
Yes,
and jazz.
Yes.
We're going to go out on this song. What is it we're going to hear?
This is Los Hombres Calientes.
Los Hombres Calientes from New Orleans, a mixture of some old school jazz guys and some younger jazz guys.
Bill Summers, Jason Marsalis, and Irvin Mayfield.
Yes. Soledad, where can we find all of the work that you've been talking about?
Follow me on Twitter at Soledad O'Brien, one word, because, you know, I love to fight with people on Twitter and have some inspirational stories as well.
We want to remind you that you can hear all the songs that Soledad brought in today on our website at npr.org/altlatino.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are NPR's Alt Latino.
Babaloo.